Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to New Books on Russian and Eurasian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Agat Guy, a host of the channel. Today, we will be talking with Shelly Fairweather-Vega, editor and translator of Amanat, Women's Writing from Kazakhstan. Shelly is a professional Russian to English translator and an Uzbek to English translator. Aside from the anthology we will be discussing today, she has translated stories by the Uzbek writer Hamid Ismailov and the Kazakh musicologist Tulashbek Asenkulov. She translated and edited Amanat with Zaure Batayeva, herself a writer, translator for Kazakh and cultural commentator. Shelly, thanks a lot for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's really a pleasure. Just so that we have a sense of place for our conversation today, could you begin by describing a little bit where you are calling from?
I am in Seattle, Washington, in the Pacific Northwest United States, where it's nice and rainy, as typical for this time of year.
Nice. And so now that we situate ourselves, to start us off, I'd love to have you read a few paragraphs from one of the pieces that you translated for the anthology, and that will be really great if you could read it in the original Russian or Kazakh form first, and then do your English translation.
Sure. I thought it would be nice to read one of the more Kazakh Russian stories in our collection. So I'll read you a couple of paragraphs of Zira Naruzbayeva's long essay called The Best Kumpir. Maybe I'll read you a couple of paragraphs in Russian first, and then I'll read you the section in English, and then I'll tell you why I picked this selection. Would that work for you? All right, so this is from the section of The Best Kumpir called Astrakhan Sheshe. Ее чтение Корана с раскатистым «А шайтани ражни» наверное останется для меня ветом несвяющим, нормативным, так как именно она читала молитвы у нас дома за праздничным Дастраханом. Эже особенно выделяла ее среди своих подруг за возраст, за знание Корана наизусть, за трудную судьбу и умение смириться, тебе, как говорят казахи. И еще она была из Астрахани, и принадлежала к тому же роду, что и мы. Она была не только вдовой, как остальные, но и пережила всех своих детей числом 13. И кое-кто за глаза называл ее Жалмауз, пожирающая прорва. Жила она с одним из своих внуков, который дважды развелся из-за нежелания жен ухаживать за престарелой свекровью. В третий раз он решил не искушать судьбу и метался между двумя домами, сам ухаживая 90-летнюю бабушку. Иногда она срывался с запой, в пьяном гневе обвиняя ее в том, что в свои 50-ти только-только стал отцом. В такое время его раздражала даже религиозность бабушки, то, что она не хочет отвечать ему и лишь молча молится за него, кладя на него серыми потускневшими глазами, Kazalchinisia, Vipuchinami, Satostimis de Glamiachko, Pinishin, a summon daily on bill procrossing the Nukum. Evil Hobatami, Anata Gila Pachtito Staviat, Nibuchom is Nayan Mustin. I'll read you the section in English. The way she recited the Quran, with her drawn out Ah, Shaitani or Rajani, will probably always seem like the standard way to me. As someone with no particular knowledge of that art. She was the one who recited the prayers around the feast table at our house on holidays. Ajay singled her out especially from among all her friends for her age, for the fact that she had memorized the entire Quran, for the difficult fate she had lived out and learned to make peace with. Taube was what the Kazakhs called it. Plus, she was from Astrakhan, which we all pronounce the old way, Astarkhan, and she belonged to the same clan as we did. Not only was she a widow like all the others, but she had outlived all her children, 13 in number, and behind her back some people called her a Jamoiz, a type of monster known as a bottomless pit. She lived with one of her grandsons, who had twice been divorced due to his wife's lack of interest in catering to their ancient grandmother-in-law. The third time he married, he decided not to tempt fate, and he traveled back and forth between two homes, taking care of his 90-year-old grandmother himself. Sometimes he broke down when he had something to drink, and in a drunken rage, he'd blame her for the fact that he was only just becoming a father at the age of 50. At times like those, even his grandmother's piety infuriated him, and she refused to answer him, just praying silently for him instead, looking at him with those gray eyes misted with age, which seemed swollen behind the thick lenses of her glasses. In fact, of course, he was a wonderful grandson, and with him taking care of her, she lived to be almost 100, never wanting for a thing. It was the 1990s, and Astarkhan Sheshe's age made me think about how human life measured up against history. Not only had she been born before the October Revolution, she had been a grown-up young woman by the standards of the time when it happened. Her lifetime covered the Civil War, collectivization, World War II, the Thaw, and God only knew what else. Astarkhan Sheshe was tall and thin and could no longer walk unassisted, although she kept her own house and rolled out the dough with her own veiny hands. And when her grandson wasn't at home, they usually sent me to fetch her to our house for a visit. It took us about 15 minutes to walk over from the building next door, and she told me all kinds of stories while carefully feeling her way with her cane. When Ajay left us, I brought Astarkhan Sheshe to our home for the wake, and after that, on Fridays, I went to see her so she could recite from the Quran in her memory. She and I sat by a table near a window, and she told me that my Ajay used to come by on Fridays just like this. And when she was going home, she always turned around in the courtyard outside and waved goodbye. The Sheshe lifted her bony hand and showed me exactly how Ajay had waved to her. For some reason, it was very important to her, and she told me about that every time I saw her. Sometimes Astarkhan Sheshe demonstrated a truly childlike naivete. Once she told me of a dream she had. Her mother was standing there, dressed all in white and waving a hand, summoning her. "What do you think the dream might mean?" she asked me. Then she went on, "I don't even remember what my mother looked like. She died a long time ago, before the revolution, and her image has been washed from my memory. But I know it was her. I was angry at her, you know. When I was little, there was a terrible infection in our owl, and all the children in our family died from it except me and my little brother. One evening, Mama tucked me into bed crossways at my brother's feet. By morning, he was dead, but I survived. I could never forgive my Mama for that." After that dream, the one where she saw her mother calling her, Astarkhan Sheshe lived several more years. That's the end of that.
It was, thanks a lot for reading that. It was really nice to hear the Russian form as well. And could you explain me a little bit, how and why did you pick this piece in particular?
Yes, this is the Beskin Pir is one of my favorite parts of the whole Amanat collection, and it's really maybe the heart of the book. Zarina Rizbayeva is one of the most represented authors in our collection. She's a mythologist herself. She studies Kazakh mythology and world mythology, which is an area that not many people have paid much attention to. So that already makes her unique. And then she's got this storytelling flair. So this essay, Beskin Pir, is sort of her tribute to the old women that kind of preserved Kazakh culture and kept it going through all the tumultuous changes that have happened in Kazakhstan over the past 100 years or more. The title of Beskin Pir means five old women, and she's kind of imagining this as a pantheon sort of goddesses and thunder grandmas, as she says in the piece. So the essay is made up of little portraits of individual women, the author's grandmother's age, their grandmother's friends and peers, who have been transplanted out of history, out of their rural setting, out of their old lifestyles into the big city of Almaty, where they have a new kind of urban lifestyle, where their children and their grandchildren are living a completely different life than the one in which they were raised. And the stories are about how they adapt or don't adapt, how successfully they can do that, and what they make of themselves, and about the author's relationship with them. She kind of jokes about herself that she felt closer to these grandmas, these women of this older generation, than to her own peers. Maybe she's an old woman at heart.
And is that why you said, because when you introduced your piece today, you said that it was the more Kazakh of your Russian text. Could you explain a little bit more to our listeners what you mean by that?
Sure. Kazakhstan is a really multicultural place. Thanks to a settlement of ethnic Russians, even before the Soviet Union formed, and then forced resettlement of Russians and other ethnic groups into Kazakhstan by Stalin and throughout the Soviet era, really. But of course, there's this indigenous population there all along, the Kazakhs and nomadic people, with a different kind of literary history, cultural history, mythology, everything. And today, Kazakhstan, I read recently actually that Kazakhs were a minority in Kazakhstan until just about the same time the Soviet Union fell apart, about 1991. It was only then that the Kazakhs became more than 50% of the population of sort of their own republic. And now, of course, they still are an independent Kazakhstan today. But this mix of cultures remains. So someone like Zira, who's very embedded in Kazakh culture and knows so much about the history on a personal and academic level, chooses to write in Russian most of the time, in the Russian language, even though her Kazakh is good. She helped me study Kazakh when I was learning it, which was a great pleasure. But she still writes in Russian. That's the easiest for her. So she tells these very Kazakh stories about very Kazakh people in Russian. Which is, a lot of people do that in Kazakhstan, but more and more, there's also plenty of Kazakh language writers, and we're translating those too, which is what we tried to do with Amanat.
And do you have also, at the opposite, Russian people who will be writing in Kazakh? I mean, Russian from Kazakhstan
who will be writing in Kazakh? That's much more rare as far as I know. Yeah, there's a trend now, Russians, ethnic Russians in Kazakhstan learning Kazakh, studying it. I think it's partly a reaction to bad behavior by Russia, the Russian Federation, in the world. They're trying to separate themselves and kind of embrace Kazakhstan more fully as their home. So it's an interesting trend to watch.
That's really interesting. And how did you manage all the challenge of, because for example, in the piece that you just gave us, there were some words that were actually in Kazakh. Ece, for example, I know it's grandmother, right? If I'm not mistaken. And so how did you manage to answer to this challenge, to translate from Central Asian languages and cultures and to mix both the Russian and the Kazakh cultures?
Yeah, that was the real challenge of the whole book. We thought it was very important to make sure that we conveyed these foreign terms. So both the Kazakh terms and Russian terms in these stories would be foreign to the average English reader, we figured. And we wanted to make sure we didn't treat one set of words as something more exotic or something harder to understand than the other set. So in Amanat, none of the foreign words are in italics, which is a sort of convention in English. The goal being not to single those words out as strange, but we wanted to keep them, of course. So some things we explain in the text. I think I added an extra explanation in there once or twice about different terms, but we try to make those explanations as subtle as possible. So not highlighting them with like a footnote, so you have to move your eyes to the bottom of the page and learn something educational, right? But just explain them smoothly within the text so it seems like a natural part of the story. And the word Ece, we don't explain at all. I think it starts at the very beginning of the story and it continues throughout. So by the time you get to the end of the best computer, hopefully Ece is just part of our English vocabulary now and it seems like the most natural word in the world.
That sounds really nice to do. And also because, as you said, for most of the people, at least in English and French speaking also countries, Central Asian languages is just this really weird thing, really, really far away that we don't really think about. So it's really nice the way you are actually approaching it and sharing knowledge about it. And I was wondering, as it is not that traditional to study Russian and Kazakh especially, how did you yourself get involved with Central Asian languages and culture?
Sure. I started studying Russian as an undergraduate. I was studying history and the Cold War, and I thought Russian would be a useful language if I was going to go into historical research, something like that. I ended up not doing that ever. But then by graduate school, I was still interested very much in the region. I took classes in Central Asian politics, economics, and things like that. And then I noticed they were offering grant money to study Uzbek at my university. So for very practical purposes, I took up Uzbek and funded my master's degree that way. But of course, I couldn't just like study it and take the money and run. I fell in love with the language, with the culture, with the literature that I was reading in those beginning Uzbek courses, and began translating from Uzbek as well as from Russian. So Uzbek was my gateway Central Asian language, so to speak. And later on, I started meeting these Kazakhstani authors wanting to translate what they had written too. So I started studying Kazakh as well. Kazakh and Uzbek are very close. They're both Turkic languages. And on the page, they look similar. So I can stumble my way through most Kazakh texts now. Conversation skills are a different matter.
Yeah, it's a step-by-step thing. I am myself learning, so I feel you. It is.
Yeah, it takes time.
It is something. So you just said that the Uzbek helped you to understand what was going on in Kazakh text. And I was wondering also, because your book is a mix between Russian and Kazakh text, did you notice any differences on theme, on style, between the Russian pieces and the Kazakh ones?
There's a little bit. I hesitate to talk about it because I don't want to impose too much of my own sort of judgment on these pieces. I'm, of course, much closer emotionally to the Russian language pieces because those are the ones that I translated and worked on. And when you translate a text, you really live in it. You read it so closely. You really, it's like method acting. You kind of feel as if you're in that text very deeply for a while. And I never got to experience the Kazakh language texts the same way. So my co-translator, co-editor, Zarya Bataeva, was responsible for the Kazakh translations, and she did a wonderful job. And she also selected, I think, all the pieces in the anthology. So it's Zarya's eye for interesting writing that is really responsible for how Amanat turned out in the end. And her translations of the Kazakh ones, she found some humorous pieces, which I really appreciate, like Jumagul Solti's Romeo and Juliet, which opens our anthology, is this very funny, almost slapstick piece about old people in a Kazakh village slapping together a production of Romeo and Juliet, half in Kazakh for some foreign visitors, with old romantic entanglements coming to light at the end on stage. And it's like, it's very funny. And we don't think about, you were saying, Central Asia seems so far away. We don't read Central Asian literature in Europe and the United States. But I think it was really a nice trick to bring not only any old Central Asian literature, but funny Central Asian literature to light here. I mean, I think it really helps to make that distant location, that distant culture more relatable and more, normal seeming to us non-Central Asian readers.
And on that topic, how did you collect it? How did you select it? Which pieces you will translate?
Also, as I was saying, Zare was kind of the scout for the collection. She actually approached me before Amanat existed with just a couple stories, one of her own, this Best Computer, which I've already read from, and a novella called The Nanny, which we excerpted for Amanat for the story that we call Hunger. So we worked on just those three pieces at first. We were able to publish them in Words Without Borders, which is a great online organization that publishes lots of literature and translation from all over the world. Once we had done that much together, we really wanted to keep working together. And so Ray says, you know, there are lots of other good Kazakhstani writers out there who have never been translated, who need to be wider read. So she started gathering things like that. And bit by bit, we translated them from both languages. And we had enough for an anthology. We started kind of promoting that to publishers and hoping somebody would take us up on it. But we wanted to make an even mix of stories originally written in Kazakh and stories originally written in English. We wanted to make sure there was some outright fiction and some nonfiction. So we have very serious stories, very humorous stories. We also cover a lot of the history of Kazakhstan. So we have stories from Stalinist time. We have stories about people thinking back to different points in Kazakhstani history, like the Beskampir and like Asal Omar stories as well. So we tried to cover a lot of history, a lot of different personalities, a lot of ethnic groups. We even have one book that's written from the point of view of a man, one story that is for a little variety, since this is such a female-centric collection. So we just hope to find, a good selection. We don't think it's, comprehensive. Obviously, there's a lot more out there, but we can't fit everything into one thin book. But hopefully this is just the first collection of Kazakhstani literature, and there will be more and more.
Hopefully, yes. And also on this thing, that is a female collection. Obviously, when one is a little bit familiar to Kazakh literature, the first thing we think about is Pustabaya, the Path of Abai, and things like that are really huge. And even in Kazakhstan, people will tell you, oh, yeah, you have to, this is the one you have to read, absolutely. So why and how did you end up choosing all female writers?
Oh, I think this is something that comes up a lot in translation in general and translated literature, just that women are just underrepresented as writers in translation in general, but also in translation. And while everyone knows Abai, he also wrote a very long time ago. His whole life is kind of shrouded in mystery and myth. But there are real, real live breathing people writing right now in Kazakhstan about recent Kazakh history, about society right now as it is. And we thought that would be interesting in a new way to readers outside of Kazakhstan. In a way, and it might be too ambitious to say, but we also wanted to make sure we could help these writers introduce themselves to each other. Until fairly recently, there was a divide in the Kazakhstani literary world between Kazakh speakers and Russian speakers. They didn't often read each other's work, review each other's work, that kind of thing. So by putting a selection of really excellent pieces from both of those spheres together in one book in English, we kind of hoped we could bring these authors together to meet on sort of neutral ground in the English language. And kind of get them more interested in each other. And of course, one anthology can't do that on its own. There's other positive developments in that direction in Kazakhstan right now, to more mutual journals, conferences, and things that bring writers from the different language groups together, which is really exciting to see.
That's really interesting. And also, I was wondering if it was hard for you to pitch the anthology to publishing houses.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
We were really happy to get such an enthusiastic response from our eventual publisher, from Gaudi Boy. Gaudi Boy specializes in Singaporean literature, which, I've never thought about Singapore and Kazakhstan in the same sentence before, but The editor there was very interested in Kazakhstan as an Asian country, and from the larger Asian world, which is great. In a way, it was really refreshing for us to work with them, partly because Gaudi Boy is not part of the kind of post-Soviet literary landscape. It doesn't have this kind of Russo-centric Soviet focus that a lot of other publishers who might have considered the book have. So again, we're looking for a kind of a neutral ground, not too Russian, not too Kazakh. So Singapore, you know, why not? And they've done a great job. Editing was a pleasure to work with them, marketing the book. It's been a very great relationship so far. It wasn't easy. It took us a while to find a publisher who was interested, who was willing to look at it and didn't, I think, just dismiss Kazakhstan as something a little bit too far away, a little bit too strange for them.
And speaking of editing, how did you choose the title of your book?
Amanat. So Amanat is a Kazakh word, but not only a Kazakh word. I've learned since it exists in lots of sort of Asian and kind of Islamic influenced languages. Amanat is the story of the title of one of the stories in our book about a mother's impossible demand on her deathbed. She wants her children to ensure that her youngest son doesn't marry his Russian girlfriend. She's a Kazakh. She wants him to have a nice Kazakh girl. She says, I have an amanat, and an amanat is something, a promise that must be kept. It could be a physical object, like a heirloom handed down to be cherished over the generations. It could be an immaterial thing, like a promise. So this book we told each other is our trying to carry out an amanat for these writers, for everything that they represent, everything they've chronicled, and convey it to the wider world.
And you seem to have a really specific relationship with the writers themselves. I was wondering, I'm not a translator myself. I do, but it's not professional. And I was wondering if, like, for example, when there is a word in Russian and you're not really sure about all the symbolism behind it, do you speak with them about it? Do you speak to them how you should translate it in English?
Often I do, sure. I mean, the author is the foremost expert on the words they've chosen. And often, I think very few of the authors in this anthology speak English or speak English very well. So the questions we ask them are not so much about how we should translate this, but, you know, what are you thinking with this word? What are you trying to emphasize? If it's sort of an ambiguous thing, are you looking at this side or that side of the meaning? And then that gives us clues as to how to best translate it into English. The trick about talking with authors as a translator is that you don't want to ask them too many questions, or they might start to doubt that you know what you're doing. So you have to do a little bit of research on your own and save the author questions for, the really profound ones that will make you seem more intelligent, I think.
Yeah, but it's also kind of a way to have the backstory of the piece itself.
Sure. Yeah. I read it. When I read it to translate, I'm only one reader, of course, with my own interpretation. Other readers will have other interpretations. But your responsibility as a translator is to make sure you don't neglect other possible interpretations of a story, right? So make sure the translation encompasses all sort of possible meanings, or at least the most obvious possible meanings. And the author can give you some clues as to what you might be missing in your own reading of the text. So you can refine that a little bit. It's a great experience talking with, a writer, somebody with such a great, creative mind, and then just trying to live in their brains a little bit and replicate their thinking and their creativity in a new language.
And do you work in team in terms of translation? So for example, do you give your first draft of translation to Zauri, and then she read it and give you feedbacks?
Yes, for this book we did exactly that. So we each translated from one language to the other into English, and then swapped pieces and helped answer questions, polish the style up, and so on in English. Zauri was a good source of knowledge about, the background, individual phrases and things, especially all the Kazakh phrases that show up in even in the Russian language stories. And then she's, her English is wonderful. But I was able to help her with a couple turns of phrase and so on. So in the end, I think we had the best possible results because of that teamwork. Yeah.
And what was really nice to actually, when you read the book, is that you really feel like you travel a little bit. Like you, especially when you know a little bit, at least, of Kazakhstan, you really can see what is going on.
I thought, you know, maybe the ideal reader for Amanat is somebody who does know a little bit already about Kazakhstan or about Central Asia. But I hope that it's accessible also to people who don't know anything, who have never thought about the place before. It's hard to judge, of course. But I hope that many readers would find something interesting in there, something they can relate to.
And do you project to translate it to other languages?
Not yet, although I have been asked, I think on social media, somebody asked if there's a plan to translate the whole thing into Kazakh or into Russian, which would be fantastic. That's not a job for me, but maybe one of these authors will take it on. And that would be great to have, you know, three different language versions of our collection.
Especially
languages too, maybe French one day.
Who knows? No, but especially as you were saying, that your goal was also to mix those two worlds, to make the Russian and the Kazakh writers speak to each other.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that will be really amazing. And I was wondering if you have any newest plans, project.
As well, I have two books lined up right now. I've got one novel from Kyrgyzstan, which is a really kind of fantastical piece about people wandering the desert. I'm going to start that actually this week. I'm excited about that. And then Hamid Ismailov has a new book too. He's the Uzbek author who I started working with initially. He is still writing all the time and all his work is wonderful. So I'll be working on one of his novels later this year, next year, I suppose, as well. So hopefully bit by bit, we'll build up a huge library of Central Asian literature in English translation, and that place won't seem so far away and mysterious anymore. That's my goal.
That sounds great. You sound also quite busy, a lot of things to translate, to do, and to share with the world. Thanks a lot for joining us today. It was a great pleasure, really, to meet you, to speak with you. For our listeners, you can find Amanat, Woman's Writing from Kazakhstan, in your bookshop in North America and Southeast Asia, if I'm right, as well as on Amazon if you live in other parts of the world and you can't reach bookshops in the US or in Asia. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. I hope everyone enjoys reading the book.